Welcome, welcome. We are back for another episode of The Lock-In. I'm David Lappin, alongside my fellow Unibet Poker Ambassador, Dara O'Kearney. Dara, how is it going? This feels a little bit like the calm before the storm. I'm about to play the Unibet Poker powered Malta Poker Festival. That's a bit of a tongue twister. And you're, of course, going to play the IPO and the Dublin Poker Festival.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we both have a lot of live coming up next few weeks. In fact, I'm also off to Nottingham afterwards, shortly after the. So yeah, it's had a few weeks between live stops, and now it's back to the live grind, basically.
Very good. Well, look, joining us this week is a poker player who perhaps is better known for his work outside of the game, where he is a statistician, author of the new book On the Edge, and the founder of 538, a company he left in 2023, taking the rights to his forecasting model, important piece of kit that, to his website, Silver Bulletin. He's also an advisor for Polymarket, a decentralized prediction platform that lets users trade on the outcome of world events. No better man for that. He is Nate Silver. Nate, welcome.
Hey, guys. Happy to be on.
Great to have you on, Nate. Okay, so there's one particularly huge world event on the horizon. The US election is on November 5th, of course, thanks to Electoral College system. It's going to boil down to the results in about six states, maybe. The popular vote, just irrelevant. One noticeable thing over the last few weeks has been the disparity between polling data and the betting line on Polymarket specifically. For a while, Kamala Harris was in the lead with the polls while Trump was becoming a decent favorite on that exchange. Since then, though, the polls have tipped Trump's way ever so slightly. Was that a case of the market being ahead of the game? Was it sharp money? Was it maybe an infusion of donkey money, in your opinion?
So I am an advisor to Polymarket. I think if you look at who is making these, taking these big positions, it seems to be largely one small group of what we might call whales, or I don't know. I mean, there's a fine line between people with a lot of conviction and people who are trying to create a narrative about Trump. But it seems to be that you have people who are putting relatively large numbers of dollars into this market and buying up any pessimistic predictions for Trump. I mean, things have shifted. We've gone from, in our forecast at her peak after the debate, it was about a 58% edge for Harris. I know it's a poker show, so I don't have to explain probability, at least. And now it's a 53% edge for Trump. So in poker, 53% is well within the range of what we'd call a race or a flip. You know, for that matter, even 57, 43 or so is in the range of where we consider it very close. So there has been some momentum for Trump. I think not as much as the markets imply. I think the markets sometimes overrate the importance of momentum, whereas polling averages more resemble like a random walk. If you won the last pot, doesn't mean that you're necessarily more likely, in fact, you're not, to win the next pot, ignoring psychological advantages. And also, in general, these markets are traded in more by people who are Trump-leaning. You know, Polymarket is not in the U.S., so you have a lot of people who are crypto adjacent in other countries, and the crypto guys generally have become more pro-Trump this cycle. So, you know, look, I think it's kind of half real and half market psychology and dynamics.
Well, one quick follow-up on that. Is there any aspect of it then where, if it is a lot of crypto money coming into the system, it's those people hedging against Kamala, if that makes sense?
It could be. I mean, it's not quite clear what your objective is with these markets, right? Some people are trying to make money, but also it's actually fairly hard to hedge different types of political risk or financial risk that you might face. You know, on the other hand, cryptocurrencies might be affected by the election too. So I'm not sure whether you're hedging or doubling down potentially, but it's not crazy. It's maybe if you're like a Democrat and you're worried about Trump winning, you should bet on Trump just so that way you hedge, right? You're like, okay, well, the guy didn't want to come president, became president, but I made a bunch of money on Polymarket at least. But I think there are more, well, I don't know. I don't want to say for sure. And there are various derivative markets and things like that, so it can get kind of complicated. But there's also a lot of, you know, if you play poker, you meet a lot of wealthy people with high conviction about politics and other things.
Well, Dara, to bring you in here, you and I have been following the betting line on this one closely since Trump started his campaign, which I think was about 5 minutes after he very peacefully transferred power on the day of love that was January 6th. Do you think the betting line reflects the actual current probabilities? I'm thinking here of some sage wisdom our dear departed friend Jan used to dispense.
Yeah, I used to have a maybe somewhat naive view that the betting markets were always maybe not perfect, but the best, the closest you could get to the current reality. That has been tempered a little in recent years by sort of an understanding that exactly what Nate talked about, like people bet for different reasons and that will always bet the line. Jan Sukanek, who you're referring to, was one of the most successful sports bettors in the world. Jan was interesting in a sense that I think he almost uniquely understood whales because he was at heart a whale himself. Anytime something on his own conviction, he was almost always wrong. So that's why when it came to the serious bets, he would just leave it to the quants and the math modelers and all the rest of it to tell him what to bet. But he still liked to have a flutter and he was often quite wrong on those. But one of the wisdoms he imparted to me was that a very quick hack to sort of get into the betting world is just to try and figure out what dumb people are betting on and take the other side. That was possible on different markets, and just always try and figure out like which side are the dumb people most likely to take, because obviously you're going to have dumb people on both sides. That's reality. But which side is going to have more dumb people moving the line in their direction? It's something I was even aware of, I think, as a kid. Like, I remember, you know, I started betting on horses, like most Irish people, at the age of four. very gambly thing. And my dad was a spectacularly bad gambler. Like, he just always, let's call him a field player. He always just went with his gut, which was almost always wrong. But then, you know, Even as a young kid, I was very mathematically oriented, and I started picking up on certain patterns. And one thing I noticed was that, for example, in a big race in England, if the Queen owned one of the horses, that horse would always start at a ridiculously low price, because obviously all the staunch royalists would just pump money on the Queen's horse out of some sense of patriotic duty. And that was sort of like super important. So yeah, it's always a matter of just trying to figure out like people, the low information bettors, let's call them that, what they're betting on and take to the line. But I mean, these days it also depends on the size of the market. Like the US presidential market is so big that like if any major discrepancy arises, you have to think people will take the other side fairly quickly.
I might actually kind of say the opposite, in the sense that like, if people are taking tens of millions of dollars in positions out to back Trump, and by implication have more money behind that, you know, look, probably market's growing. It's not easy to get necessarily. If people want to bet $100 a bet, right, then it takes a lot of $100 minnows to make up for a $40 million whale or whatever. And for the biggest events like the Super Bowl or the World Cup in the US NCAA tournament, I remember going to Vegas a few years ago, as I often do, when there happened to be a Conor McGregor fight, and all the sharps, and you go to Vegas, like lots of Irish lads everywhere, and there's like, you know, whatever proper 15 whiskey he's hawking or whatever, billboards everywhere, and all the sharps are like, this is a great bet against Conor McGregor, right? Because this is a market where there's not that many sharp UFC bettors, and of course, if you're sharp, it's hard to get action down anyway, and so they were betting heavily against McGregor.
Yeah, I think we all backed up the truck on that one. Nate, you recently tweeted, it's a sociological experiment to see how much Nate haters and strange new respect for Nate people switch places when the forecast goes from 50.1% Harris to 50.1% Trump. So I guess my question now is, Nate, why when you say things I want to hear are you brilliant, and why when you say stuff that I don't want to hear are you trying to destroy America?
Yeah, look, Harris and Trump have spent all but, the forecast has been live since July 29th. They have spent all but like 9 days somewhere in the range of 40-60 either way. And it doesn't take that much to tip a 60-40 advantage to a 40-60 advantage. But psychologically, that feels really profound. If you're up 55-45 versus 45-55, that feels like, oh, I'm winning or I'm losing. And look, people in politics are in some ways kind of the polar opposite. There's some discussion of this in the book, polar opposite mindset of people in the gambling world where, I'll try to say this as nicely as I can, right? But they see politics as kind of like a moral contest, that, you know, you're on the righteous side, the right side of history, and you vote out of your patriotic duty. Whereas I look at it, I mean, I have political views, but I look at it as like a handicapper might. And those are just very, very opposite mindsets. And I think it kind of like rubs certain people the wrong way. And so people think I'm rigging the numbers or that I'm conspiring with Polymarket or whatever else. And I know I've been doing this long enough where it just comes with the territory, I think.
Well, speaking of the book, your new book, On the Edge, The Art of Risking Everything, you delve into the mindset of probabilistic thinkers, people you call reverians. I hope I pronounced that right. Your contention is that whatever area of life these people hold positions, be it maybe politics or the tech world or in finance or whatever, they're becoming increasingly powerful and influential in society. As simply as you can put it, why does living in a world of expected value, marginal utility, game theory, and abstract models give you a leg up?
I think just as the economy becomes more financialized and quantitative, so, you know, the dominant, increasingly dominant industries in the US at least are tech and finance. I mean, those just happen to be the skill set, the analytic ability, coupled with kind of the urge to gamble, right? I mean, I think, you know, I play poker with some of the guys on Wall Street and they're pretty degenerate for some of them are anyway. That skill set is really rewarded by the market. And also it's a high variance skill set. If you can combine those two things, being really gifted about the different aspects of trading or betting. So part of it is knowing how to do good models and price the fundamentals. Part of it is having, frankly, the guts to make trades and be as risk on as you should. And part of it is also reading people, understanding how market dynamics work, right? Not getting too caught up in momentum sometimes. If you have that skill set, then that's kind of what gets you to like the tail 0.001% outcomes. I mean, everyone I talked to for the book is extremely competitive, from like the poker players to the hedge fund guys.
I'm sure. Well, Dara, we spoke actually on a very recent show with Dylan Weissman on this very subject. You brought up how you gave your friend a lesson in probabilistic thinking using dice. I know you have a funny story involving some other friends when you were able to manufacture, let's say, an advantage by essentially keeping your probabilistic wits about you while others lost theirs. Can you tell us that one?
Yeah, sorry, you're going to have to remind me, David.
I might have been in Hong Kong, perhaps.
Oh, in Hong Kong, yeah, you actually asked me this question. Now I remember that this was the first time I thought about this a long time. So in the early 90s, I found myself in Hong Kong working for a bank as a sort of a tech consultant. And I was there for a few months. And some of the people I was working with started bringing me to the horse racing. And, you know, I'm not by nature a gambler. Like, I don't actually enjoy gambling, but I'm always looking for an edge, obviously. And I very quickly spotted a pattern in these horse races in Hong Kong at the time. Don't know if it's still the case, but they were all six horse races. They were all nags. So, like, form went out the window. Pretty much any horse could win. There were no bookies. So it all went on essentially what we call a tote in this part of the world, what essentially the same as a betting exchange. You just bet on whoever you think you're going to win, and if that horse wins, you share all of the pool minus what the betting exchange takes with the other people. So, but you can follow the odds in running. And what always happened is one horse, they'd all start off around the same price, and then one horse would become favorite, and then all the money would pile on that horse. Like, there was a real herd mentality of like, oh, somebody knows something, that horse is going to win. So I started literally just betting on the other five horses. That's all I did. I didn't even care what the horses were. I didn't know what their names were, form, anything. I would just always pose the favorite. And I was absolutely printing money to the point that when my contract ran out, I actually stayed in Hong Kong for a few months afterwards, just doing this. I used to also take the ferry across to Macau because it was a race course there, which was very much the same scene, sort of like six random nags running against each other. It always amazed me that, like, literally the same thing happened every time. People would decide, okay, this horse is favorite, so he's probably going to win, so I'm going to put my money on him, rather than thinking, well, yeah, okay, but everybody else is betting on him, so if he wins, I'm going to get back my money plus 20% or something.
Well, I know I know how seasick you get, Dara, so I'm guessing you must have been really printing to be getting that boat across.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no. I mean, I hate going on boats. It's the only time I've ever voluntarily gone on a boat.
I think if you play particularly cash poker, and it doesn't have to be high stakes, but this is probably more pronounced at high stakes, lots of otherwise intelligent people, even people with kind of quantitative adjacent skill sets, just commit the gambler's fallacy and the hot hand fallacy and rationalize randomness, rationalize winning streaks and losing streaks to a degree that few human beings overcome. I mean, even I'm sure as poker players, we do it. I did an experiment for the book where I bet the NBA, the National Basketball Association, for a season in 2021-22, and like, you know, went on some predictable losing streaks and winning streaks. And you really do think you're like God's gift to sports betting when you have a week where you win 16 out of 20 bets, which can happen sometimes, and vice versa. It's just kind of human nature, because those instincts, like most things we encounter in the real world, aren't like randomly generated data sequences. You know, I don't know if it's, I'm not like religious or whatever, but like there are reasons why, you know, herds of animals you're trying to hunt down are in packs and things like that, and not just randomly in the population. And so, when we encounter like truly random numbers, then we really don't know what to do with it. and the groupthink, and the, like, you know, not wanting to buck the consensus. And there's this kind of like circular logic where, okay, polymarket moves, that moves other prediction markets, that starts to move Wall Street even. I mean, there are things you can look at that are more pro-Trump or pro-Harris. I won't go into that too much. But then it seems like there's a consensus when it's kind of all one catalyst that touches off a narrative, and then it becomes kind of like kind of self-fulfilling potentially.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stick with this, but maybe put it back in the context of the book. You call the people who have this sort of risk mindset, as opposed to the Riverians, these guys are the village. Again, they come from all walks of life. They adopt partisan identities, are more inclined towards the center left on the political spectrum. I think you suggest that too. You said in the book how villagers see the river mindset as too much unbridled capitalism and too little moral concern for the public good. On the flip side, Riverians see the village as conformist, risk averse, and obsessed with identity politics and culture wars. As a proud Riverian, do you think that the village's focus on equality, its attempts to better capitalism and its risk mitigation, are stifling for our species?
For the species, that's a big term. I mean, I think that growth, technological and economic growth, has substantially improved the human condition. I think this is a part of history that people don't know, as well as they maybe should. You know, I think there's also room to worry about inequality in the wealthy Western world. Let's keep in mind, though, that countries like India and China, which were once impoverished, are catching up. You know, I'm going to take a trip to Korea in January, which is one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world. Korea was poor for much of its history, and now it's very advanced. At the same time, I mean, look, in the book, you kind of meet poker players and sports bettors who are kind of like doggedly sympathetic characters. And some of them are characters, but then, you know, when you apply that situation on Wall Street or in Silicon Valley, then it becomes very much a winner-take-all economy. It's very much like a poker tournament in that respect. And I just worry about, like, when someone like Elon Musk accumulates more wealth than, like, more than half the nations on Earth have, depending on how you measure that, for example, and that very top of the chart kind of goes up every year. I mean, I'm not so concerned if some people are doing pretty well for themselves. I guess I am concerned when, and you've seen this, a bigger flex in American politics this year, where Elon, for example, has pledged to randomly choose a voter if they sign a petition supporting the First and Second Amendment. That's for the non-Americans. It's gun rights and the First Amendment free speech. This is illegal, by the way. You probably are not supposed to give money to someone for signing a petition. Because it's limited to registered voters. It's a way to get people to sign up to vote for Trump, get on their mailing list. But the fact of just like randomly giving away $1 million a day is pretty insane, I suppose.
But then all bets are off because, you know, thanks to Citizens United, his money is just his speech, so he can do what he wants with it, right?
Well, look, Democrats have actually raised more money overall from small donors. And so, you know, Elon trying to, I'm not going to say rig the election because it's not rigging or anything, but Elon trying to influence the election is a powerful metaphor for Democrats to fight back.
For sure. Dara, back to you. In his review of Nate's book, Matt Glassman says the following. He says, at the heart of the book is a simple proposition. Imagine I offered you a choice. You can have 500 bucks, no questions asked, or you can roll a die. If you choose the die and it comes up any other number but 6, you get nothing. But if it comes up 6, you'll get 5 grand. This book is about the people who take the 500, but it's also not about the people who think for a couple of minutes and choose to roll the die. This is a book about the people who instantly grab the die, can't imagine not instantly grabbing the die, and think anyone who doesn't instantly grab the die is somewhere between irrational and insane. Now, there's no doubt that all three of us here would instantly grab that die. However, let's assume for a moment that we cannot lay off or share our risk with some of our maybe network of fellow Riverians. Let's assume we have to take on all the burden of that risk ourselves. There is a point where the subjective value of the money does make us consider the proposition maybe a little more deeply. To push it to an extreme, if it was a choice between 50 million or a dice roll for half a billion, I'm not gambling. Does that mean that when you ultimately test me, Dara, I'm really deep down a villager?
I don't think so, because I think there's the whole idea of economic utility. Like, how much better is your life with a couple of billion than if it's 50 million? Like, well, Arsene Wenger famously once said to Nicholas Anelka, when Anelka was thinking about big transfer money, he said, you can only sleep in one bed and you can only eat 3 meals a day. Yeah. You've already reached the point where you have enough money to sort of do everything that you want to do. Why would you risk that? I think the rational choice beyond that certain point where it's really not going to make any significant difference to your life is not to risk the amount.
I'm so relieved.
Let's say you have a net worth of, I don't know, $10 million US or something. I mean, at that point, you probably own a very nice home or two. You probably own a very nice automobile or two or three, right? You can travel in luxury accommodations whenever you want, and eat whenever you want, and you have a big nest egg to donate to your friends, leave behind some inheritance to your children, and protect yourself in the event of a medical emergency that isn't covered by insurance and so forth, right? And so, like, if you increased your net worth by 10x, then okay, your life maybe gets 5% better, right? It doesn't get 10x better. Now you own a third home and you have to hire a staff to maintain it, right? Or maybe you can invest in businesses and things like that. But there are pretty sharply diminishing returns.
For sure. Well, actually, Nate, sticking with you here, in an attempt to bring this back maybe to the election, the MAGA people don't feel to me to be in either group, really. They despise the values of the village, put it that way. It's what they target most of their derision. But they also don't strike me as river folk. I don't think of a Trump rally goer as having a probabilistic outlook. Maybe that's unfair, but I just, you know, have watched some of these rallies. I've watched some of the interviews with people at these rallies. That's not what strikes me. So what are they? And for that matter, what is Trump?
So another reviewer described the rest of the world as the wilderness, right? Like, the river and the village are both communities of highly successful, or at least aspirationally successful, elites. Some are successful financially, some have a lot of cultural capital, and some have both. So it's kind of the 1% versus the 1%. Trump himself is a weird case. He's clearly very competitive and very risk-taking, and I think probably has some degree of street smarts. He understands leverage. He probably understands on some intuitive level, not in some formal John Nash level, game theory about reciprocation and things like that. He's not very analytical or patient. He's very, very gut oriented. He also ran a casino business into the ground, which is not easy to do. It's not, by the way, they were nice casinos when they were founded. They turned into shitholes later on. They were nice when they were founded, but he was so impulsive, he took out loans junk bonds at like a 14% interest rate, and casinos take a long time to pay off. I mean, they're very, very expensive investments, and you hope that they have 30-year or 40-year shelf life. And so to do that is just totally insane. He's not really in either. I think he's probably closer to the river, but he also seeks the approval of the village. I mean, he felt piqued allegedly by being teased at like the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is like the most villagey of villagey possible events, where Obama was making fun of him and some of the comedians were. And he's like, fuck these guys, I'm going to run for president. So I don't think he really fits into either camp.
Fair enough. Actually, this is all making me feel like there's a sort of an overlap here. Darragh, what Nate does very successfully, obviously he's demonstrating it here in his books and whatever. And actually what you do too, because he's attempting to simplify complicated statistical models and probabilistic data for the masses, while you attempt to simplify poker. Now this is the point where you get to do your little plug. There we go. There it is.
Oh yeah, right. So you're going to do this.
How much of a tightrope is it that you have to walk when communicating complex things in a digestible manner, Darragh? And how much do you have to onboard the sentiment, the perfect is the enemy of the good?
Yeah, it's something I've talked quite a lot about, because I think I've always had this impulse right through my whole life, but I don't think too many people have this impulse. I think a lot of people actually have the opposite impulse, that when they learn something, they don't want other people to know it, because somehow it makes them less special when other people understand what they do. And that's why we have all, you know, every area of expertise develops its own language, essentially, in terms of slang. Whereas I've always sort of been the guy who's been more interested in trying to explain it to people outside the tent, what it actually is. You know, long before poker, one of the first splashes I made outside my immediate social group was back in the 90s. I was involved in tech, the early days of the internet. I worked on the first HTML project, and that was full of people who were like, we're the smartest people in the world, and we're doing something which is really different. And then when the internet started to percolate into the wider community, people sort of like, most people, a lot of people, particularly older people, just didn't understand it, you know, because they weren't tech savvy. And I wrote a series for the main Irish national newspaper called Everything You Wanted to Know About Computers, But We're Afraid to Ask the Kids. And, you know, the National Broadcaster even commissioned a TV series on, which unfortunately never got made. But that has always been sort of my impulse, to try and explain the complex concepts to outsiders so they understand them. Because as I see it, like, one of the dangers for humanity as we get more and more specialized is we have all these specialists who have their own area of specialization, yeah, but don't know anything outside that area. And that sort of diminishes the value of everything. You know, humanity is based, humanity's evolution socially has been based on the idea that, you know, if one person learns something, they can teach other people, and then everybody in the group knows it. And we don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. But it seems to me in modern day and age, we're getting so increasingly specialized and so increasingly in small little tribal groups, with often no real desire to communicate with the other groups, that's going to become a long-term problem. Now, in terms of your question about how difficult, like, it's always a question, I think, of just trying to understand the level that people are at and put it in terms that they understand. And try and think of some way to explain it. You know, you mentioned that story I told on a recent show, where a very smart friend of mine in New York, very successful lawyer, but a real Nate hater, because he's convinced that Nate, in inverted commas, got it wrong when Clinton lost. And I tried to point out to him that Nate's prediction actually gave her a bigger probability of loss than pretty much every other measure at the time. And so therefore, in a sense, he got it right. But in his mind, it was like, it's binary. If the number is more than 50 and it doesn't happen, then you clearly got it wrong. So I tried various methods, and eventually I came on the roll of dice method of, like, if we roll a dice and you can take 1, 2, 3, or 4 and I can take 5 or 6, what are you going to do? And he said, well, obviously I'm going to take the 1, 2, 3, 4. And okay, and if the 5 or 6 comes up, then were you wrong to make that choice? And yeah, I think he kind of got it then, but you do have to sort of recontextualize, reframe stuff, try and understand where they're coming from and also what they currently understand.
Yeah. Look,
go ahead, Nate, sorry.
No, that's right. I think some people have trouble making the leap from an event like a dice roll, or even like in a sporting match, where if you watch enough sports, you know that, like, you know, penalty kicks in football are kind of random sometimes, or red cards and things like that. And you kind of get that intuitively. People have trouble doing that for elections or, and by the way, there are different levels of, like, you know, in principle, if we could perfectly survey every voter in the US, everyone responded to polls and they were extremely honest. There would be some uncertainty based on things like, what will the weather be on election day? So therefore, you know, your tires go out or something like that, or there still is 2 weeks left as we're taping this. But you'd be pretty freaking good, right? Whereas in some sense, you would never, there's intrinsic randomness in, like, a basketball game or a football match to some degree, right? Probably irreducible to some degree. And people, so the intuition isn't necessarily wrong, but it's also a matter of epistemic humility. If you have strong beliefs in elections or some other things, you go to Polymarket, you can go to other betting markets, you can go to traditional bookmakers, and there are lots of ways to bet. And almost always when people make these claims and say you want to bet, then they get squirrely and back down.
Absolutely. Well, I want to now get to your excellent podcast with our great mutual friend and now bracelet winner, Maria Konnikova. The two of you have put out about 25 or so episodes at the time of recording, and I think I've tuned into all of them, or pretty much all of them. It's a fantastic mix of poker anecdotes, politics, sports analysis, topical news, other stuff too, all viewed through the lens of risk. I really recommend it. If you're not already listening, you should absolutely obviously make this first, but then make that your second favorite one. One subject that's come up a fair bit on that show, Nate, is AI, actually, particularly more recently. That's something that your book deals with as well. The crux for a lot of people on this topic is the question of compatibility between AI and human values. I've read a lot on this topic, as clearly you have too. Clever people are out there creating artificial brains right now that will just get smarter and smarter every year. And before long, everyone will have an opinion on the fact that this is happening. Do you think that humanity will ultimately split into two philosophical or ideological groups? One that wants to build these massively intelligent machines that could be viewed as immortal, I suppose, at some level. And then another group that tries to stop their creation, almost like a Skynet-esque fear that, you know, maybe these machines will decide they don't need us.
Well, look, if you believe what, like, Sam Altman at OpenAI says, the other AI leaders, they say we want to create super intelligent machines that can do almost any, at least mental task, better than any human can. And by the way, the physical tasks might not be that far behind. Like, the high dexterity tasks are hard, but I was in San Francisco recently, took a driverless taxi that's frankly one of the better rides I've ever had. They're pretty good. Look, so given these claims they're making, and I don't give them 100% chance of being true, or maybe even not 50%, but, like, clearly a lot of credible people believe that these machines will eventually become super intelligent, then I don't know what comes next. I mean, yeah, in general, you know, when there are technological revolutions like the Industrial Revolution, there are also political revolutions like the American Revolution, or the French Revolution coincides with the Industrial Revolution. You know, I don't know if we've developed philosophies or governance strategies to deal with this. I think there is some chance of a big backlash, and maybe the humans win, or kind of preemptive efforts. I also think there are other scenarios where it's a bit more like ordinarily technological growth, but amplified to some degree. So it's not, you know, GDP in the Western world grows by 2% per year, roughly speaking now. Some people think with AI, it could go off in a singularity. But what if it grows by 5% per year? That compounds pretty fast and makes a lot of difference and would feel tangibly a lot faster. If you go to a country, Singapore or something, where they have 5% or 7% growth per year, then you really notice that versus going to Ireland or the England or much the US even. I worry about a world of haves and have-nots, where if you are one of these weird people who was, you know, working on HTML back 20 years ago or something, then you really get ahead. And if you're not, then you get kind of manipulated by the algorithms. I mean, if you look at the casino industry, you know, that's also becoming haves and have-nots, where if you, if you know what you're doing, you have high agency, you know which games offer positive odds, meaning the skill games, which odds offer less bad odds, like craps, and you know which odds totally screw over the player, like slot machines, for example. You know, if you're knowledgeable about how the skin industry works, you can go to the Wynn or the Aria or whichever other nice casino you want to go to and have a pretty good time and get your comps and see your friends and play a little poker where you have a positive expectation, hopefully. If you're not, then you can have a very bad experience. A lot of people become addicted and things like that. You know, the sports betting industry in the US is not as rapidly growing as the one in the, or not has, has not been around as long enough as the one in the British Isles. It might be less mature, growing very fast. And there are people who probably aren't ready for that either. And so I worry about algorithms being used to manipulate people. I also worry about putting too much faith in the algorithms and saying this thing is all intelligent when, you know, it's buggy or has low fidelity or things like that.
Yeah, great points. Darrell, one thing I have been thinking about recently is there's obviously a perception by some who frankly don't know better that poker is a game of chance. Those people are still out there, maybe less of them, that it's just gambling. Maybe, in fact, some of the soft money even comes into the game because of the existence of those people. But given that AI is not able to play profitable roulette or profitable Punto Banco, but is able to play profitable poker now. We've seen this obviously with the solvers, maybe better than profitable, maybe like elite level profitability. Do you think AI's emergence has actually done anything to make those that don't realize that it's a game of skill that it is?
I mean, maybe there are some people, but like, to be honest, I think the type of people who just don't understand the skill aspect of poker are, who can't get past the idea that just because there's gambling involved, that there can't be any edges. Because there are people like that too. I mean, I know people who think, for example, that professional sports bettors are just lucky because they're like, well, they don't know what's going to happen. And they're just lucky that they bet on the thing which happened. And they can't get past, because they essentially, what the problem they have is they just don't understand the probabilistic nature of the world. They still had this belief that if something happened, it was always going to happen. And if something didn't happen, it was never going to happen. And that's just, so I don't think those type of people are necessarily going to be convinced by AI either. I would be maybe more interesting to speculate on what kind of mad conspiracy theories are going to come up to justify why AI isn't able to beat roulette or the other ones, but can beat poker. I'm not too optimistic on that front, I have to say.
Well, finally, Nate, going to end with this one. Once again, going to try and bring things back to the election, the week that's in it. When Maria was on this show a few months ago, we asked her, how risky would it be for the Democrats to switch horses late in the game? Biden stepping down was, shall we say, in the air at that time. Then, you know, a few days later, the show went out and he actually decided to step down. And I think it was the very day the show went out. So it was kind of like we were revealed for having recorded a bit early. Looking at that decision now, was it the right one? Like, Biden's economy was and is, despite what some people say, in my opinion, doing great. Like, inflation is back to manageable levels. Infrastructure bill is a really tremendous bit of legislation. There's loads of other accomplishments as well. He had perhaps hadn't even kind of begun the serious process of like selling his accomplishments, maybe still trying to govern and not going into campaign mode yet. Nonetheless, he was floundering the polls, I totally accept. And of course, he did have that ghastly debate performance. There was a sense at the time that he was doomed, I suppose, and that she had a puncher's chance. I don't know if you echoed something kind of similar, I remember, in an episode of Risky Business too. Do you think now, with just over a week to go or whatever it is, no matter what happens, no matter what the outcome, because we're probabilistic thinkers here, was she the better option?
Absolutely. It was an extremely bad idea for Biden to want to be president until he was 86. And this was very consistently flagged by voters in polls. He showed that diminishment in a lot of ways. And just objectively, aging is nonlinear, unfortunately. When you get into your, you know, very late, by the way, Trump's too old too. Let's be clear about that. When you get into your late 70s, early 80s, then you know, I guess unless you're Doyle Brunson or something, then you probably lose some degree of sharpness. I'm sure Doyle might have as well in some respects at the margins, at least. You know, look, I think Biden still hurts Harris's chances in some ways. So the Biden people blew up the debate calendar. If she had another debate, which she's very good at, then it might be easier to have a moment that gave her momentum. And the fact that Biden was too old makes it harder for Harris to talk about the fact that, like, Trump is too old. But no, look, I think, so I understand your point about the economy. There's this gap between kind of objective data on the economy and subjective perceptions of it. Now, the Biden administration did decide to pump a bunch of money into the economy to help labor markets and were successful at that. It caused more inflation than the economists were hoping for. There, you know, there's no rule. Year over year, inflation in the U.S. is back to normal or normal-ish levels. There's no rule that says a voter has to only look 1 year back. I mean, Biden's been president for 4 years, and the overall amount of inflation over the past 4 years is high. Immigration is a big deal in the U.S., where the border policies were pretty lax. But also, there's just kind of a general backlash to the left. This kind of goes in cycles, I think, and progressivism had a big moment in some ways and made a lot of progress in things ranging from gay rights to drug legalization to, you know, most countries around the world have raised taxes on the rich. There's been some improvement in environmentalism, right? You go and, like, there's a lot more public transit in places around the world and things like that, not in the U.S. necessarily. And there's a backlash to that. And Trump is a populist, is a slightly polite term, who is skilled at, like, harnessing that backlash and making people feel like he is on their side. So I actually think that, like, these are pretty difficult circumstances for any Democrat. Harris has the further disadvantage that she kind of has to own the Biden legacy, or she's unsure about whether she wants to own it or not. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I called her in the Post today, like a little bit of a calling station, right? Where, like, where you're not sure what to do, so you just call. And it's kind of like, well, I could say, hey, I disagree with Joe about X, Y, and Z. Or you could say, you know what? Actually, the economy is doing great and we're going to own that. And she kind of does neither, really. And that's, I think, a difficult position to play from.
Yeah, she's definitely walking across a bit of a tightrope right now. And it is interesting to see what will happen in this one. We do apologize maybe to some viewers, although hopefully not too many, for a sort of change of pace. So we always talk about poker, and it's pretty much all poker on this show. But we have a little habit here of doing a pre-election episode, and who better than yourself to obviously come on that one? Brian Paris did a great job, and in fact, I think this episode might have been picked up, Dara, do you recall, by RTE, the national broadcaster that Dara mentioned earlier, in Ireland, as at least doing something a bit more refreshing with the election coverage. I guess a lot of people look at the day-to-day stuff, and at least we're looking at probabilities and things like that, Dara.
Yeah, I was actually very impressed by our national broadcaster. Not just that they picked it up, but the way they ran with it, sort of an attempt to explain to the masses that there were these people who thought about these things probabilistically, and yeah, that was certainly a nice bonus of the last show we did. You know, I'm always happy to see an attempt to sort of educate the masses on this stuff.
Absolutely. Well, look, it has been absolutely brilliant to have you on the lock-in. We appreciate your insights, of course, a whole host of topics we got through, even if not too many of them were poker adjacent. We wish you all the best with the book, the podcast, and also maybe any bets you might have on the election too. Nate Silver, thank you.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Nate.